Oh, I was going to say, keep going. That was nice. Jason Robert Brown, thanks for having us.
Happy to have you. I guess you're here in my house. So yeah, I'm happy to have you. It's very nice that you came out to visit me instead of making me come to you. So yeah.
I'm so thrilled that you let us come over and visit you.
Indeed. Well, and you'll see the dog later. He's hanging out down here. But
that's right.
Yeah.
Stephen Sondheim said that your song, I Love Betsy, was his favorite opening number since The Music Man. Why do you think he felt that way? It's a great song.
I have to tell you that when I heard that, initially, I was as mystified as anyone could possibly be. It wasn't just that he loved I Love Betsy. He actually came to see Honeymoon in Vegas and was there. They gave out lays when you walked in, so he wore his lei and had his tropical drink and sat down in his seat and had the greatest time. And like through the whole show, and the whole cast was like, this is the show Stephen Sondheim is going nuts for? And he just loved it. I think, you know, I deliberately had written Honeymoon in Vegas as a throwback show. I was trying to write something that felt like it could have been written in the 60s. And so I think it really did, on some nostalgic level, feel like what a musical is supposed to feel like. As far, you know, for someone like Steve especially, it was like there's a golden age craft of how musicals are written, and I was deliberately dipping into that for Honeymoon in Vegas. So I think on that level, it was just sort of like, if you think no one's ever going to write that kind of score again, and then you hear it, you're like, oh, I love that. It's an enormous compliment to me that I was able to craft something that I think convinced him that I had the chops to write that kind of stuff. You know, it was a lot of fun to work on, but the picture of Steve with the lay on and the big tropical drink walking to his seat is still sort of seared in my memory. It's like, I can't believe this happened.
So what was it about that opening number, though, that he just loved it so much? I guess it's kind of what you just said, where it felt nostalgic to him.
Well, I think when you talk about what are the values of that particular style of musical theater, and there is, first of all, there's a lightness to it. There's a wit to it, which I was really trying to do. And there were actual jokes. There were actual laughs. And so that was key. But they were all set up in very, very rigorous ways. There aren't any false rhymes in the whole song. It all lands. And it's built structurally to do exactly the sort of thing that a number does, which is to set up the entire world of the show and who these people are and what they're doing, so that within the song itself, there's just the dramaturgy of the song does what a classic opening number should do. But I think also it's musically a lot of fun. And I think there's the several different sections, you know, there's the sort of the samba thing. So I think there's that idea, and then there's we go into halftime with the I don't remember how this song works anymore, but the 5 years I've been in love with Betsy for 5 years. I can't believe she stuck with me. I should probably know what key that's in. I do the song all the time.
I was going to say, I feel like you just played this the other day, right?
Or not the other day.
Oh, okay.
But, I have played it fairly well, since we're just rolling. Hold on, I have to figure it out now. Now I have to know. She loved me. Oh, it goes to the 5 years. And then we're going to halftime in 5 years. I can't believe she stuck with me. What kind of a luck have I got to keep someone like her around? And then even after that, there's the sort of the stretto, which is the Betsy loves me. I'm a schmuck, but Betsy loves me. Doesn't matter what I do, I know it's true. This is what I always think of as the Alan Menken bit. I could never live without her. Betsy loves me. It's amazing. Betsy loves me. And then we go back to the samba. So I think that it has that whole sort of tripartite structure. It just tells you everything about what the show is going to be in a way that I think, you know, that's sort of what Steve always aimed for as well. You know, I was just trying to take the lessons, but I think I think a lot of writers who grew up in Steve's shadow take the lessons of the later stuff. They take the lessons of Sweeney Todd and of Sunday in the Park with George, certainly, and even Into the Woods. And I think that is a very specific model for how to build a show. But for Honeymoon in Vegas, I went back to, funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. I deliberately was like going back to Gypsy and to shows that had a very sort of old school structure to them.
How do you make some of these opening numbers work, like The Hills of Home for Parade, which is like contextually what the musical is about, but it's not really what the main plot is about, or even To Build a Home from Bridges of Madison County. You sort of go back in time, and again, not really talking what the show is about, but they still work. So how do those work?
I think in those cases, both of those are functioning as prologue. And that's true in The Connector as well, that sort of what I want to do with those first 4 to 7 minutes of the show is to give you enough information that...
We've got Jason's live dog.
I want to give you enough information that dramaturgically I can then jump into the story without having to do anything else. And musically, and this is really what's important, is that musically you know what the world of the show sounds like. And so in the case of Parade, I don't think you can understand the story of Leo Frank without talking about the Civil War. I think you have to go back and talk about what that was to Atlanta, to Georgia. And so Alfred Urie and I both knew we wanted to start during the Civil War as a sort of prologue. And so it made sense to me to then do, you know, the Civil War and then jump ahead 50 years to where we were in 1913 in Atlanta at the beginning of that story, just so that the minute we introduce Leo Frank, which is what we do the second the song is over, they all sing this big home on this big F chord, and there it is, there's home, we cut off, and what we hear is the word Leo, and we see him walk into this place where he doesn't belong. So, like, that to me felt very dramaturgically very full and very rich, and I don't need the opening number to feature the lead character of the show. It works in Honeymoon in Vegas because, again, that's a certain style. But I think the lead character of the show, in the case of Parade, is actually the city of Atlanta. You know, I think that they are actually more what the show is about than even Leo and Lucille. So to me, I needed to introduce them in the opening. Bridges was much trickier. It took a long time to figure out what that was supposed to be, but that was Bart Scheer said, I mean, what if we think about it like a Thornton Wilder thing where we build the world, like, you know, this house that she and her husband live in, this is what her family is, and she sort of built this. What if we built that on stage? And I just took him literally, and I was like, well, then let's do it. Let's literally build a house on stage. That's not ultimately how we staged it, but I thought we could, you know, I thought we could literally just, that's what the number is meant to do. And so we do that by, you know, we're also building, you know, we build that motif until finally it's everybody's all playing and the whole thing is good. And then we go to major. And finally, when we're in the... So that it's just all about building, so that by the end, when the whole company is in and everybody's in this home that she has built, again, we can then start the show, which is what we really do the minute that song is over. Bud comes in and they're off to the fair, and that's the engine of the show is starting. But the opening number, in a lot of my shows, the opening number is really there to just sort of say, this is the scenery, this is the world we're in, this is how the world functions, and now that I've set that up, we can go. And that's true of 13 as well, though 13, the show changed from the original version of the opening number I wrote. So the opening number that's there now sort of serves the old version of the show better than it serves the current version of the show. But
I'm trying to think of, like, Sondheim's later works, like, you know, the opening number, Tend the Tale of Sweeney Todd. I'm trying to think, does that lineage of an opening number,
yeah, well,
is that more of this
exactly
type,
that. Tend the Tale of Sweeney Todd is specifically a prologue. You know, yeah. There's no plot being told there, but it tells you this is what you're going to see. This is the world you're in. You're in London, you know, you're with all these people and they're all in their costumes and they're all singing, you know, You know, we're all in that world so specifically that by the time the next thing starts, which is where the boat comes on, and you know, we see Anthony and we see Todd, and, you know, in the streets of London, we're like, right, we already know where we are. We've got enough information to get rolling. And I think that's, you know, that's a great thing that opening numbers can do that you sort of can't do in a play, obviously, because, you know, you have to just get rolling with the storytelling, and that requires you, therefore, to do a whole lot of exposition stuff. And I figure if I can get all of that out of the way in the opening number, then all the better.
I was watching this masterclass you gave almost like a decade ago online, and there were a couple of kids who came up, and they were playing pieces that they had written for you, and they were sounding very Sondheim-esque. And you had made this point that you were like, I think Sondheim's biggest regret was that he Sondheimified all of musical theater, but that so many people were kind of using that style wrong. I don't know if you remember saying this.
Yeah, that was more than 10 years ago. That was probably about 25 years ago, but yeah.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. What is the Sondheimification of musical theater, and where does it go wrong?
I don't even know that it's a relevant question anymore, because I think it's sort of vanished. I mean, musical theater now is so heavily pop-oriented that whatever Steve's influence was is pretty heavily dissipated, which I think is not for the better. But just in terms of the rigor of the writing and the discipline of the writing, I think that we've lost something with a lot of contemporary musical theater writers. So for all the years that I was like, why does everybody have to sound like Steve Sondheim? Now I sort of wish people would sound more like Steve Sondheim. But there was a sort of persistent, first of all, a sort of persistent wordiness that was not necessarily, it didn't always sing very well. It was just sort of like, the idea was like to pack a lot of words into things. And I pack a lot of words into my songs, but they're always sort of very character specific. And they're also, I'm trying to work melodically around that idea. But I think there was a lot of just sort of like noodly meandery stuff. But I think there was also, like on an accompaniment level, there was just a lot of, you know, just everything very piano-based and everything sort of very figurative. And I just think it all started sounding a little samey. But it was samey, but I don't know that any shows that had that, I don't know that there was ever a preponderance of successful musicals that sounded like that. I think it was just what young musical theater writers were taking on at the time. And I think now there's an equal number of unsuccessful musicals that just sound sort of like, you know, random pop songs, you know, thrown into a show. And the good stuff is going to find its own voice, and the good stuff is going to find its way forward, because good writers are good writers. As with any art form, most of the people who do this aren't very good at it, but the people who do it at the highest level are excellent at it. And so, you know, I'll take anybody who's good. If they want to sound like Steve, great.
How good of a piano player do you think Sondheim was? Like when you did that concert at Town Hall and he was playing?
Well, he was 90 years old when we did that concert. When Steve was younger, he was a pretty fluent pianist, and you can hear it. There are demo recordings he did of his own stuff, and you can hear he just totally nails it. And even the thing in you know, that would, you know, that requires a certain, actually he wrote it in B, I think. Yeah, no, it plays much better that way. So I think he had a certain amount of chops, but he never wanted to play in public. You know, he never wanted to do anything in public, really. He liked giving speeches and he liked being interviewed, but he didn't like singing, certainly, or playing in public. So he wasn't much of a practicer. And so by the time I got to know Steve, he didn't play very much. And I think he was just out of practice, and then he got nervous about doing it and stuff like that. But, the reason those original scores are hard, he could play them. You know, that was what his fingers did.
Yeah. In the same masterclass, you were talking about the last 5 years, and you were talking about the song, I Can Do Better Than That. You were using as an example where you said that song basically just gives tons and tons and tons of detail, and the only reason it works is because in the very last line, basically, she says, will you move in with me, which is the big point of that song.
Right.
That's like my favorite song from the last 5 years, and yet I never realized that's why it works, because at the end, it's not just a rambling. At the end, she says that.
Right.
How did you write that song, or what was the intent behind that? It was that moment.
Well, I mean, the point is, like, what was that? You know, there's no dialogue really in the last 5 years, so each song had to be an entire scene. So what's the point of any given scene? And the point of the scene wasn't, oh, let's drive down and visit my folks, you know, in on the Eastern Shore. The point was, you know, how are we going to move this relationship to the next level? I'm ready for you to move in with me, but how do I set that up, and what am I doing? And so that, on a character level, the song always was, I have something I want from you, how am I going to get it? And the song sort of leads in a variety of different tendrils and ways, but the reason she starts where she starts is, we're about to go to this place where I grew up, and I want you to know that I'm never going back here. And that's when she says, I will never go back anymore. That's all still setting up to, you know, say you'll move in with me. And so the whole thing is about why she won't go back there and what she has, you know, how she's planning to live her life at another level, at a different place, and how Jamie's going to be a part of that. And so, so to me, the song needed to do that. But I also knew that if she drops that bomb too early, then the song, I think, again, we're being really specific about this one song, but I think that key to the song is, a lot of times when I'm talking to actors about how to build their way through a song, I say to them that you have to assume that you're going to ask the question and get no, because if the answer is yes, then the song's over. So you have a thing that you want, and you're going to get no, and you're going to get no, and you're going to get no, and then finally you're going to get to the end of the song, and either you will have gotten the thing you want or you didn't. The trick about this is that he can't say no, that if she ever asks him, will you move in with me, and he says no, then it's actually, that's too much to recover from. I can't have her then do a second verse. It's like, well, no, actually, let's think about it this way. And the whole point is, she's going to ask once and it's going to work. So in order to pull that off, I had to have a whole long runway for her to ask the question so that it's going to be yes. So that's the trick of the song, is that it doesn't do the sort of iterative thing that a lot of my material does, which is like, we're going to ask a question, we're going to get no, we're going to ask a question again, we're going to get no, then we're going to do a bridge, then we're going to finally reiterate it, and this time we'll get the answer we want. I can do better than that. It's really like, I'm setting up so that I'm sort of demolishing all of your defenses in advance. And so I just needed to figure out structurally how to make that work. And so, you know, knowing that it was all taking place in a long car ride, knowing that, you know, what was going to happen. I mean, at the end of the first verse, she says, oh, do you need to take a break? You want to stop at this, you know, like this exit and all of that stuff. So just like what happens in a car ride, you know, and what's on the radio and all of that stuff. And whenever I'm staging the song, I always, you know, she's always got to deal a lot with the car and the window. And, you know, there's a lot that she can do to keep the momentum of that going. But you know, it's just, any material like that is tricky. It's a 5.5 minute song, and trying to sustain the momentum of that dramatically when nothing's happening, it's up on me as the author to keep saying, there's something coming, I promise. And I think the audience does perceive that. The audience does feel like, where is this going? So that when we get to the end and she says, say you'll move in with me, then it's like, oh, that was it. There's just a relief on the audience's part that, oh, that's where we were going to. And we know that it worked, you know, because obviously we've seen through the whole show that they did move in together.
Is that what drags you through, though, is you're just waiting in suspense, like, where is he going? Is that why we stay with that song?
Well, I think dramatically that's why you're staying with it. Musically, hopefully, it's just a lot of fun and you're just enjoying the music.
Yeah.
You know, and structurally, it's not a very complicated song. It's a long, each of the pieces of the structure is long, but it's basically an AABA song. The B has a couple of different chunks to it. But, you know, if you think of the A as both the verse and the chorus, to go, well, I guess there really is the same thing, but you know, it's just this thing, you know, and she goes into Carol Ann with, that I can do better than that, and that's the first A. And then we literally do the exact same music. I mean, there's different bass tracks, but the same music, the second A is the same thing structurally. And then we go to, you don't have to get a haircut, you don't have to change your shoes. And then this is where we sort of do an extension on the B, And the only reason I did this, first of all, the point is that this is late in the show, so I knew I had a lot of stuff that the audience could, like, pull from. Like, if this number was where it functionally happens in their relationship at the beginning of the show, I couldn't have made it this long. But when she sings the, I want you and nothing but you, we've heard that already in See, I'm Smiling. And so we know what it is that she's referring to. She doesn't, but we, you know, it, that matters to me. I wouldn't have included that section if I were doing the show in chronological order because it wouldn't have meant anything, but it means something to the audience to go back to that. So that's why we extend the B, is to add that section, which just gives a little more cohesion to the piece as a whole. And then finally we get back to the last A. You know, I don't need any lifetime commitments. I don't need to get... And then we extend that A at the end just to... get to the say you'll move in with me thing. But so it's really just an AABA structure, which most of my songs are. It's a little bit attenuated, you know. And again, I hope that's to sort of keep the suspense up, to keep the energy of the song going. Also, it's a long drive that they have.
Do you remember coming up with the line, you don't have to like prosciutto?
I do. There's a real thing about the...
It's my favorite line in the song.
It's a specific line about the 90s that people who weren't alive then don't understand. But, you know, the show is meant to take place, you know, between 1994 and 99 or 93 and 98, whatever you want to do. But in the late 80s, it was the first time that you could import prosciutto from Italy. There had been a sort of embargo on it for years before then, and people don't remember this. But what happened, therefore, was that once that embargo was lifted, once whatever lobbyist managed to get prosciutto allowed, you know, cured meats allowed in the States, you were just flooded with prosciutto everywhere you went, and a lot of it sucked. It was just lousy prosciutto. And so I would go to eat dinner, and inevitably there was just like a pile of shitty prosciutto there. And so I couldn't bear it. And if I saw it on a menu, I was like, oh great, prosciutto. So that's what she's referring to, is like this onslaught of dreadful prosciutto. Then, you know, like years after the show happened, I moved to Italy and I was like, prosciutto is the greatest thing. And I would brush my teeth with prosciutto. Prosciutto is the greatest food that ever happened. But it's so specifically built in that time. Anyone who was around then knows we were just getting attacked with prosciutto day and night. So that's why you don't have to eat prosciutto.
And it's just such a fun word to say in that song, isn't it?
Weirdly, in the show I'm writing now, I'm writing a show called Less, and there was another place where it was just the perfect word to rhyme with something else that I was doing. She says Pluto, and she then rhymes it with prosciutto, but both of those songs are in the set that I do in my concert, and Neja Thomas, who's been my soloist, sings both of those songs, and I just think it's the weirdest thing in the world that I wrote two songs with prosciutto in them, and you can hear them both in the same hour and a half of my of my life.
That's why you're you.
Exactly. I'm the prosciutto guy.
Was this song one that you'd almost been writing in different forms? Like, to me, in Songs from a New World, there's like a couple songs that almost feel like this one. Like, The World Was Dancing almost feels like an earlier, different take on a similar type of song. Or even I'm Not Afraid of Anything seems similar. It's same family, it's different, but...
I think in terms of the way the actor works their way through a song, I can see how those three things are similar. But I would say that I Can Do Better Than That felt very much like... The whole of the last 5 years was really my taking all the things I learned from writing Songs for a New World and all the things I learned from writing Parade and putting them into the same show. And so I don't feel like I could have written a song as rigorous and as dense as I Can Do Better Than That if I hadn't gotten old enough to do it. But I think there is a very clear line in my work. I mean, you can follow sort of me getting better at what I do, you know, and I think that line follows all the way through to The Connector. As one should, I think I'm just getting better at what I do. But I hear the last 5 years as being much better writing than I was able to do in Parade, and much better writing than I was able to do in Songs from a New World.
What were the things you learned, though, in Songs from a New World? I feel like when you listen to that, even though what you're saying, and I understand that in some ways the songs get better, but you still notice, you see the fingerprints of like all your work.
Oh, yeah.
In Songs for a New World.
I mean, I always say, I wish someone had told me not to use all my good ideas. You know, because you use all your good ideas when you're 25. And nobody told me those are all the ideas you ever have. That, like, what I'm doing now is still the same stuff. It's just, like, refined and turned upside down. And, like, anything I can do to keep recycling the same idea without everyone knowing that that's what I'm doing. So I think a lot of Songs for a New World is just me, like, spraying out ideas. Like, whether they work or whether they land or whether they fit into the world of the song or not. I'm like, this is an idea. This is an idea. This is an idea. And that barrage of ideas can be very exciting. You know, I think it can be sort of, like, exhilarating for an audience to just sort of get hit with that much information, you know, all the time. But I also, it's a little bit exhausting.
What did you learn, though, from doing it? Is it just the sense of how to keep refining your style? Or was it something else you learned that then moved you into Parade and then moved you into the last 5 years?
I think that the trickiest parts of Songs for a New World were about how to sustain a single idea dramatically for a long period of time, you know, without dialogue to set it up, without, you know, necessarily scenery or costumes or anything like that. You know, those songs are all very self-contained, but I wanted them all to be, it's a little pretentious and inaccurate to call them one-act plays, but I wanted them to be very complete little dramatic portraits. And I think, you know, it was just, it's a hard thing to do. It's hard to pack, not just pack as much detail as we did, but figure out which detail is the right detail to pack into it. So I think the process of writing Songs for a New World was really the process of, like, finding the songs that kept building and kept, you know, aiming someplace and kept their momentum and kept their energy moving forward without sort of dropping. And I know the songs that we cut from Songs for a New World, and they all feel like, no, right, we cut the right songs, because they were things that didn't ultimately organically build the right way. And I'm not sure that all the songs that are in there get all the way there, but that's, I was, you know, 24 years old, you know, I cut myself some slack on it, but that's what I think I learned, is just sort of how to sustain this really high wire act of putting a solo performer in the center of a stage for 5 minutes or more and just having them hold the audience with the storytelling, you know, and what do I have to do musically to do that? What do I have to do lyrically to do that? What am I expecting of the actor to do that? What am I expecting of the director when I do that? And so I think that I got a lot out of that process, because there are so many of those kind of songs and a lot of different flavors of those kind of songs in Songs for a New World. Then when I got to Parade and I didn't have to worry about how do I contain a story, you know, that way, what it really was about was then how do I build a story from one end of a show to another? Like, what are the tools I need to get these people from, you know, the first part of 1913 until this day in 1915? Like, what is that supposed to be? And musically, compositionally, what is that, you know? And so there's a lot of sort of leitmotif stuff. I leitmotif is, again, a little pretentious way to say it. There's a lot of motivic stuff in Songs for a New World, and, you know, that sort of thing that comes up all the time. You know, it's all the same, just a trend. But that does give some kind of musical cohesion, but it also doesn't matter.
Were you thinking about, like, Merrily We Roll Along? You have, like, transition one and transition two, like, was that, it's a totally different thing, but was that a little bit of the inspiration for those transitions?
Probably, yeah. I did Merrily when I was, you know, 16, and it really did, I did think of that as, like, oh, that's how you write a score. So I think the idea of those transitions being little separate things that you could put in there, that may well have come from Merrily, and obviously the last 5 years very much comes from Merrily. So there's some motivic stuff in Songs for a New World, but I think in Parade, it was much more deliberate. This idea of, you know, how does that build to all the wasted time? Oh, da, 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 da. And, you know, how am I going to... all of the ways that I could then use that and the... which also turns into, you don't know this man, and like all of these things that bring these ideas together, so that when he sings the Shema to the Old Red Hills of Home, it's both very unexpected, but I've been feeding you the information throughout the whole show that tells you that it's going to be there. I think, you know, Parade was just, it was a real composition. you know, in the way that I would expect to write a symphonic piece, the way that I was using thematic material, the way that I was sort of, you know, using contrast and pace and all of that to just build this large kind of symphonic world. So when I look at what I had to do for Songs for a New World and that idea of these like individual moments that are completely isolated from story but can still sustain themselves, and then Parade, which was in fact, you know, something of the opposite, where they're much shorter fragments of things, but they are meant to build over a long period of time to get the story told. I think, oh, that's how you get to the last 5 years, is you combine those two ideas. You know, they are almost entirely, obviously, solo numbers that go for a pretty long time, but they're all sustained by story. They're all sustained by this one general story that I'm trying to tell.
My favorite song placement in Songs for a New World is Just One Step, because it basically comes at that point where you're like, oh, you think you know what this is? Here's something totally different.
Yeah.
Where you guys sitting around, you go, this has to go here because we're going to show you out of the gate early on. It's just anything can happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the Christopher Columbus thing is weird enough to begin with. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, we're already like,
what is this?
What's happening?
Yeah.
You know, you start with just people talking to you and they're saying it's about one moment. And you're like, okay, well, I you know, and that's review structure. You know, I've talked a lot about it, Closer Than Ever, Richard Maltby and David Shire's piece. That starts with a song called Doors, and it basically is all a bunch of people singing about it. You just walk through doors your whole life, and that's, you know, it does what it's supposed to do because musically it sets up the world. And so that's what the first part of the opening of Songs for a New World does. But then, you know, we just, out of nowhere, you know, and we're into sort of this Spanish sailing ship and off onto the new world, and you're a little like, oh, we're doing that. We're doing like real story. We're doing, you know, things that are like,
it does feel connected to the opening.
Yeah.
Kind of that. And they sort of flow into each other.
And yeah, so now you think, all right, now I know what the show is going to be. And then, you know, and just all of a sudden there's a swing beat happening and you're like,
what is
okay,
this
is definitely not any, but the whole point of the show is to constantly keep coming at you with, I didn't know where this was going. I didn't, you know, cause you know, you're not supposed to, it's not supposed to add up to a story, it's supposed to add up to an emotional experience. And so for me, I'm like, let's keep coming at you from different angles. But it was very deliberate to say, let's go from this thing from 1492 to let's go to this thing that's right now.
That's right. Okay, my favorite song in Parade, I don't know if this is most people's favorite or not, but it's This Is Not Over Yet, which is maybe, I was thinking about this, maybe in some ways the most tragic song in musical theater, because he is, it's so triumphant, you have no idea what, he doesn't know what's going to happen. So it's horrific. So it's super tragic.
Yeah.
But it's the only song in the show that really feels like that, right? So when you were writing that, were you waiting for the moment where you were like, I can have this one song that's going to be pure joy?
I have to tell you, it was one of the last things we wrote. I don't remember what happened before it. I don't remember what was there before we wrote the song, but I remember specifically that we were a little like, you know, we just built the second act and that moment didn't happen. And I think Hal was like, we need some moment where, you know, he's hopeful. And it's one of the things in Parade that I'm like, I like This Is Not Over Yet a lot, but idiomatically it feels a little bit like I step out of the world of the show, because I think I was just,
well,
sort
that's
of,
what I'm referencing.
You know,
to
yeah.
me, that's what works, though, is it's the only moment of hope in the show.
It's a moment of hope, but I mean, musically, I just feel like it's a little bit like, I feel like I'm writing some rock and roll tune, you know, in the middle of it, and I'm a little like, you know, the show does not otherwise give Leo that,
right,
that kind of vocabulary, and deliberately. And to be honest, when we, I wasn't sure we had a singer who could do that. You know, Leo was always written to be sort of not a very hard sing. And then I wrote This Is Not Over Yet, and it was like, well, unfortunately, now we really need someone who can sing it. You know, when we did the first workshop, there was a Canadian actor named Albert Schultz in it, and This Is Not Over Yet wasn't in the show yet. But All the Wasted Time was. And even the big note at the end of All the Wasted Time, the big F, was like a catastrophe. We were like, oh, this is not going to go well. So we knew we needed a slightly better singer. And then we had Matthew Broderick do one of the readings. And it was like, he's a slightly better singer, but I feel like the show still needs to like step. And then when we got Brent Carver in, it was like, oh, And I wrote, "This is not over yet." And Brent could just sail through that easily. And I was like, oh, well, then this is obviously what the show needs. But I think, you know, when Ben Platt did it, he was often like, does this show want to go up a step or something like that? I'm like, it's an acting piece. Like he's got to be buttoned up the whole time. If he's just belting out and singing the whole show, then it doesn't.
He was saying key wise. He was like,
yeah, well, he wanted to be able to step into the singing more. And I was like, if you step into the singing more, you're not really being Leo Frank. Like the one place you get to do it is, you know, in the second act when you finally open up and you get to do "This Is Not Over Yet." And then finally you get to do "All the Wasted Time." But if you've done it before then those things don't have the cathartic power that they need.
Wait, so you're saying you don't really remember it, but to dig a little deeper. So Hal says, "I think we need a moment of rejoice or something."
I think it was, "We need a moment of hope." And I remember I actually wrote it and it didn't have the bridge in it. Like the first version I wrote of it, you know, "It is not over yet." And I taught it to Brent and we showed it to Hal in rehearsal. He was like, "It's great, but it's too short," which he never said to me ever. That had never come out of Hal's mouth that I needed to write more. And so that's when I wrote the journey. So I added that into it, which actually, where he sings the line about suddenly loud as a mortar, there is hope. There weren't mortars yet. That wasn't a thing. That didn't happen until the First World War. But nonetheless.
Wait, so then that riff, to me, that's like your Billy Joel influence.
Yeah, exactly.
That riff,
yeah.
Right?
Right. Well, that's because I was under pressure from Hal to write the song. And so I just had to go into whatever bag of tricks I knew how to have, because I had already pretty much like written the show. So I was like, I know what it is. So that one, yeah, I wasn't... You know, which, all right, so.
Like, angry old man, or.
You know, so.
Kind of with, like, a little Summer Highland Falls.
Yeah, sure.
In the, you know, the way it's so manic, kind of.
Yeah, you know, it was just, I mean, and the energy was right. Like I said, there's just a sort of kind of rock and rolliness about it that I'm a little like, but it works.
It works, right?
Yeah.
Wait, so just play the riff again, because it's so good. So that's you sitting down, you say, "I just need something quick."
Yeah.
That's, "What's my bag of tricks?"
Yeah.
And you're saying you don't really remember it, but do you remember sort of, was that like the first thing you played, or did you have to sort of massage that motif?
Well, you know, I mean, that motif bounces around a lot anyway. You know, I'm always displacing where the eighth note falls. You know, over the course of the verse, I'm all ending. You know, so that you can never really tell where the downbeat is going to fall in it. I probably just did that. I probably did just go. What do I have to do with this? And then, you know, when you get to the chorus, the reason why I have to break up all the periodic stuff in the verse is so that the chorus can be. Because if I've been just hitting quarters the whole time, then in the chorus, then it doesn't work. But because I keep breaking up the quarters in the verse, it's very satisfying when I land there in the chorus.
Some of those lines, too, are so sneaky funny. Like, "My brother's portion of my estate,"
yeah,
or "My rabbi's eulogy can wait." Like, that stuff, it's kind of dark, but it's very funny, kind of, right?
Yeah, I mean, the hardest thing about Parade was finding lightness in it. You know, it was just trying to figure out where there were places where it could be light. And I'm not generally, like, I don't rely on myself as a comedy writer. Like, I can do it, but it's hard work for me. You know, I think for, like, Bobby Lopez, that's waking up in the morning. He's a funny writer. For me, it's like, I really have to... do it so that there's sort of lighter lines in "This Is Not Over Yet," but there's not really enough room to get laughs out of them anyway, because, you know, we got to move through it pretty fast. But Alfred was good at the laughs, so fortunately, yeah. The book has a couple of good jokes in it.
Is it fun as a writer to write really demanding work where you're writing something I feel like all your work is so demanding for whoever takes part in it. Is there a joy in that?
Yeah.
Or?
I love virtuosity.
Yeah.
I love watching virtuosity. I love being in the middle of virtuosity. I love being able to display it. It's great. it's not an end in itself. You know what I mean? I think as a storytelling end, just writing something that is difficult, that's not interesting to me. You know, you could be Brian Ferneyhough and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't get you anywhere dramatically. But I think, you know, there's something enormously satisfying about watching the Olympics. You know, it's like when you watch somebody do something that you're like, I don't know if they can pull that off. And then they do. And you're like, oh, so when you hear somebody singing something, you're like, oh, are they going to go? And then they get it. And you're like, ooh, and then they do even more than that. You're like, oh, great. So that's just exciting to me. I love virtuosic musicians. And I come from jazz, you know, and jazz players are always trying to top each other and trying to figure out ways to cut and to show and, you know, all of that. And that's part of storytelling if you're inclined that way. Or it can just be sort of jerking off. But, I mean, I like to believe that the boundaries of the drama keep it from just being sort of empty jerking off. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I love virtuosity. I love working with artists who can deliver something really difficult and just do it like it's, you know, waking up in the morning.
You know? You posted an interview on Instagram that you gave like a decade ago. And in that interview, this was a decade ago, so I'm curious if you still feel this way. You said most musical theater writers, what did you say? Are bullshit artists?
Oh, most musicals suck, yeah.
Or most musicals suck.
Well, they do.
Were you saying most writers suck or were you saying most musicals suck?
No, I mean, well, most writers suck for the same reason that I said before, just because the majority of any art form sucks. I mean, you know, most painters suck, you know, that's a given. And most paintings, therefore, suck. But no, most musicals are terrible. But the reason most musicals are terrible is because the chops that are required to get a musical to be good are just, it's very iterative. You have to just do it over and over again. You have to really care about, like, what's the really good thing? And you have to be able to identify, like, what's the good thing? How do I get there? And then drill down until you get it, until you get it, until you get it. Like, being a professional writer is a hard thing, and it's a commitment that you're making to your craft and to your work. And so I think when you say, oh, I'm gonna hire this pop writer to write a musical, and then you're sort of surprised when it doesn't land. I'm like, of course it doesn't land. They haven't spent their whole lives doing this thing that I do, like this thing that I have spent my life doing. I'm not even sure that most of my musicals don't suck. They may, you know, I don't, but what I know is,
how would you know?
Right, I'm committed to my work. Like, I'm very proud of my work, but I don't let it go out into the world until I am. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the buck stops with me. I take enormous responsibility for the work that I put out. And so that body of work is something I feel immensely proud of. You know, I wouldn't stamp my name on it if I didn't. I think, you know, there are young writers who know intuitively and instinctively the kind of work you have to put into doing this. And then there are young writers who are like, oh my God, I wrote a song. Isn't that cool? And I'm like, well,
I did that in Songs for a New World.
No, I'm pleased. Songs for a New World is that's the product of a lot of distilled information already. That's years and years of me working as a songwriter to do a thing specifically. That's not like, oh, gee, it turns out I can do that and then that and... oh, look, I wrote a song. Like, you can write a song. That is, by definition, like, you can get to a song. But how does a song serve a character? How does it serve a story? How does it musically build? How does it do all the things that it has to do? That's just hard work, you know? And how does an audience perceive it? What happens to an audience when they're sitting, watching something? How are they taking in the musical information? How are they taking the dramatic information? Like, what are you giving them? Are you giving them enough time to get it the right way? Are you giving them a chance to respond? All of that stuff is really important. You have to figure it out sometime. But if you don't know to even look for that, then yeah, your musical is going to suck.
There's only, though, I feel like 5 or 6 maybe name brand writers that have multiple titles they're really familiar with. You're definitely in that category.
Yeah.
It just seems crazy that there's not more, even though it's so hard. There's so few prolific writers of musical theater.
Well, no, I mean, part of that is that it's very hard to get shows produced.
Yeah.
And so if if you're just a songwriter, you can make an album, you can put it out sort of any way you want to, and you can just get better at it by doing it all the time. And there's nothing stopping you, really. I mean, if you want to get on a label, then okay, then that's like a hurdle you have to climb. But even so, there's, you know, a great many albums released by a label every year. On Broadway musicals, last year there were 5, you know? And if you added off-Broadway shows, maybe you got to 15 or 20 shows. Like, in the entirety of New York City, in an entire 12-month period, there might have been 20 shows. Can you imagine trying to run the Grammy Awards if there were only 20 albums that came out? You know, there's just very little that is contributed to the art form because the real estate becomes an issue and because the elements of collaboration that are required just require a lot of people and a lot of money and all of that. So I'm not surprised that there are only 5 or 6 brand names that do it. There may end up being slightly more than that. But, you know, I'm not surprised because it's a terrible way to make a living. I mean, there's just no way. I've got shows that I can't get into a Broadway theater, you know, and I'm like, that's okay. I, you know, if it's not going to make the, it's all about real estate, and I have no truck with real estate people. I loathe real estate people as a general rule. Look who's running the country. But, you know, so if I can't get into your real estate business, then my show functionally doesn't exist, which is just weird. Like, I've written it. It's there.
So how do you brand your shows? Because your career is basically a story of, basically none of your shows had initial success. Yeah. And then they go on and they have massive success. And then they get revived on Broadway and they become super acclaimed. Is there any kind of strategy for when you launch a show? Like, is there any advice you can give on how to have your shows live past so then they get licensed and they get turned into a Netflix movie? Is there anything you can point to, or is it just...
No, the only thing I was ever strategic about was with the last 5 years, I was deliberately writing a show with 2 people in it that I was writing. I was like, this show will get produced, you know? And I had seen it already with Songs for a New World that people were like, oh, we like the small cast thing. And so I think I was very deliberate about, oh, I want to write that. And with 13, I was very deliberate about, I want to write a show for kids. You know, I wasn't even thinking, it has turned out to be very helpful that all the kids do it. But that really was a personal one for me that I just wanted, I wanted to connect with that energy and see what it was. I never thought we'd be on Broadway. That surprised me. No, there's no strategy to my career, or at least nothing that I could possibly pass on. I think the main thing for me is because I do the concert work that I do, I'm constantly pushing the shows back out there. Like, they stay alive in ways that they might not if I weren't out there pushing them. But no, I'm as mystified by this career as anybody is. It doesn't make any real sense. I think, in a way, somebody like Joe Iconis is kind of doing what I started doing. And certainly when Be More Chill came to Broadway, I was like, yeah, see, that's the model, is you do the show that you care about and you do it somewhere out in the world. And then it sort of gathers enough steam that people are like, oh, well, we have to bring it to Broadway. But I think it's part of why it's hard for me to get some shows produced now, is if you're an investor in my shows, you never see the tail end of what I do. You know, I financially see the tail end of it, but the investors in the original production of Honeymoon in Vegas will never see any of that money back, you know. And so I think for those people, they're a little like, well, we like Jason's work, but I'm not going to give up my $200,000 to invest in it this time.
So how do you juggle that? You just keep searching to find the right people to get involved?
I don't really worry about the money part. I had to with The Connector because I love that piece so much, and we wanted to get it on and we just couldn't. And I finally did sort of like suck it up and say, fine, I'll raise the money. And so we did, and I raised the money to do it. But without turning this conversation into a conversation about money, I just decided that I would rather, I think to understand Bridges and Honeymoon in Vegas and Mr. Saturday Night, those were jobs that I was hired for. And that was my determination after the last 5 years. I was like, I'm tired of doing this thing and having people tell me they don't believe in it, and then ultimately it turns into this great, you know, thing, but I've had to push this boulder uphill all this time. So in the case of those shows, they were really like, no, I want someone to hire me to write something, and I'm going to write it, and I'm going to write it well. I'm going to write it great because I can do that. And that was what happened with Bridges, and to an extent it's what happened with Honeymoon in Vegas. And certainly what happened with Mr. Saturday Night, that I was just like, great, I'll just be a gun for hire. And I enjoyed doing it and I liked it. But then there were two projects that I worked on that did not come to fruition ultimately that I spent a long time on. And those were both based on existing IP. And I think I got tired of seeing musicals based on existing IP, and I certainly got tired of writing them. But more than that, I just thought, well, I don't have to do that anymore. So now I just write the things that I care about, some of which are based on books or things like that, which is fine. But I, you know, I just figure I'll write the stuff that I'm passionate about. And ultimately, I have enough in my head about how to make something producible. So I think I can get it to the finish line, even if it's not going to be on one of those theaters in Midtown.
Yeah. Okay, we're starting to wrap up here.
Yeah.
In this article that you posted from a decade ago, you were talking about if you want to write musical theater, really get a certain, you know, the classic shows into your bones, really understand the classic shows. You listed a couple. I'm just going to list a couple really classic golden age theater shows. And can you just say the first thing that comes to your mind about what's important to know from them, take away from them? You could play a couple motifs if you feel inspired. Just the first things that come to your mind about these shows.
Okay.
Okay, starting with Guys and Dolls.
Everybody loves Guys and Dolls. Guys and Dolls is really funny. And I think that's the main thing about it is, I mean, the music's great, but it's just, it's a musical comedy that actually gets laughs. And I think that's the main thing to really appreciate about Guys and Dolls is no matter what else you talk about with that show, it is so specific in its comedy and everything lands. And you can't hear one of those songs in any other context. You know, you couldn't do a show and put a Guys and Dolls song in it and not have everybody go, huh, that belongs in another piece. It builds its own world beautifully and it's really funny.
So take away the humor from it if you're going to study. Figure out why it's funny.
Yeah, well, certainly, because that's one of the things that Lesser was sensational at. He was a great comic songwriter. You know, you don't necessarily get that out of Most Happy Fella or something like that. There's lots of funny stuff in Most Happy Fella. But what made him sort of a star songwriter was he knew how to land a joke.
Okay, Sunday in the Park with George.
Sunday in the Park with George, it is such a crazy avant-garde piece in so many ways. And what's exciting is to see, you know, Steve was my age now when he wrote it. Steve was in his 50s when he wrote it. And he had spent his life writing maybe about some unconventional subjects, but he certainly wasn't writing unconventional structures. You know, he wasn't writing shows that felt like, what is that? And Sunday in the Park with George is really, on a lot of levels, a deeply avant-garde piece of theater. And there's something so exciting about watching someone who's completely in command of his craft take on this idea that's like, great, I'm going to do something that's sort of wild, something that I haven't done before. And to hear how he does it musically and to hear how he does it structurally, and he's bringing all of this craft that he has. Like, you listen to that opening number, that's an old school opening number. Like, you wouldn't listen to that and think, oh, I'm in for a crazy ride. But he could pull that off because he had the chops to write a number like that. And then to still within that be able to do Finishing the Hat or Putting It Together, or We Do Not Belong Together, or the Sunday, all of these things that are ultimately like just organic to the show in the most beautiful and unexpected way. It's a show that entirely builds its own rules and then sticks to them. And that's the hardest thing. That's the hardest thing in the world to do, is to like say, these are the rules of the show and I am abiding by them entirely. And there's, you know, there are a lot of shows that I really love. That's my dog. There's a lot of shows that I really love where at a certain point they have to abandon the rules. You know, they just abandon one rule and you're just sort of like, oh. There's a great moment in Lightning Piazza at the top of the second act where everybody's all singing in Italian because the rule of the show is the Italians are all going to sing in Italian.
And then the mother breaks.
And then the mother has to break the rule. And it's a great laugh, but it always makes me feel a little bit like, oh, I wish we could have nailed it. Like, I wish you could have figured out some way to do that without breaking the rule.
So follow the rules. That's what Sunday in the Park with George does really, really well.
Well, follow... I think,
or don't follow the rules.
I think it's about invent the rules. It's like any piece you know, Steve, exactly. You always say, you know, form follows content. Like whatever the content of the show is, that's how you dictate what the form of the piece should be. And this idea about what is art and how does art exist and how do we connect to each other through art, that thing is such a it's such a full and rich idea that the only way you could fully explore it was through this particular crazy form where we jump forward 100 years and, you know, but all the characters are sort of played by the same people. And like, there's this whole crazy structure to it, but it's all built into the show from the outset. This is how the show is always going to work. And that, you know, so anyway, that's Sunday.
Okay, last one, Falsettos, which a lot of people cite as a perfect show, right?
Oh, I don't think Falsettos is perfect, but I think it's amazing.
It's amazing.
Falsettos is the most personal kind of show in the entire world. Like, no one on earth could have written that but Bill. And those characters are Bill characters, and they speak in Bill ways. Like, Bill's lyrics can be really effortful and really weird, and you're sort of like, that doesn't, that's hard to sing. Or like, oh, you're just saying that to get the rhyme that's coming up. But in Falsettos, it all works because those characters are so quirky and crazy that you just fall in love with them. And I think ultimately that was the way it was with Bill too. Bill was totally quirky and crazy and difficult, and you know, he was kind of impossible, but you fell in love with him because there was at the center this sort of this huge heart. You know, there was this huge beating heart to him. And Falsettos has a huge beating heart. I mean, it's important that Sunday and Falsettos are both Lapine's shows, that Jim Lapine wrote the books for both of them and directed both of them, because I think that influence is very significant. I don't think Sunday in the Park with George could exist without Falsettos, because Falsettos also sort of like does not try to do anything that a traditional musical does. It just says, I'm going to write a bunch of songs that are sung by characters, and because of that, it's going to be a musical. And so it invents its own form. It's this crazy sort of cabaret review that ends up having like a deep storytelling soul to it. It's just nuts. And if you look at the progression of Falsettos from In Trousers to March of the Falsettos through Falsetto Land into sort of what the show became, you see a writer sort of learning what his rules are as he goes. Falsettos is... it's an object lesson in like what personal theater can be. I don't think you do something like A Strange Loop unless you have Falsettos. Like, there is a level of personal musical theater, real personal expression, which I think for me, the last 5 years is kind of my contribution to that genre. But I think you don't get that without Falsettos. That's a piece that, maybe like if you go back to Al Carmine's or something like that in the early 70s, you can find writers who were doing things that were of a similar bent and that came from that kind of what I will call kind of avant-garde, but maybe best to call it just sort of experimental theater, that off-Broadway world where it was like, well, anything goes here. We don't have to abide by the rules of the curtain goes up and the curtain goes down and, you know, those people are in the wings and the orchestra's going to play. But they just created their own worlds. And Falsettos definitely comes out of that tradition.
Okay, to wrap up, give us one final musical from the genre that you feel like has something that people need to study or people need to learn from. I'm putting you on the spot here.
You're not.
Could be a Sondheim, could be a very simple answer.
The easiest thing in the world is West Side Story. West Side Story is exactly the musical. I could study it. I could watch it every day. I could dive into it. I can listen to it as it goes by. It's harmonically and rhythmically and melodically, it is so rich and so full, but it is always connected to who those kids are. And the lyrics are really fun and really smart. And yes, they're show-offy, but whatever, they work. And, the way it integrates dance into the storytelling as part of the vocabulary of the show. Like, you cannot do the show without the dancing. And that's such an amazing thing to have done. I mean, of course, it's, you know, Jerry Robbins, that's what he wanted. But to make a piece that is so fully integrated, like, you can take the dancing out of On the Town. It's not as much fun, but you can still do the same show in concert and it works.
They have to be in the gymnasium dancing.
They have to do it. Yeah. Like, you know, you just need that in order for the show to work. Those characters dance and sing and they speak. And they, you know, it's like that to me, in terms of like how you build a musical, it's very definitely like you listen to it now and it's 1957, but it is perfectly built. It is, for all of its flaws, and it has a lot of them, it's just a perfect machine. It always runs.
When Sondheim would say he hates some of those lyrics, especially that Tony sings, because he feels like...
I'm sure, and he's probably right,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Also, they're the right lyrics. They're the right lyrics for Tony to say. That's sort of like that moony purple shit that I'm sure is what he hated sounds exactly right coming out of that character. It builds that character, and incidentally, was very much Lenny. You know, that kind of schmaltzy stuff, that I think that was Lenny's heart. He loved that. And so Steve sort of, you know, grabbed onto it. He's like, oh, I see what Lenny wants to do. There's a place for us, somewhere a place. You know, this sort of mawkish things that Steve would never write again for the rest of his career. But the fact that they're in West Side Story, I think, is a reflection of what that collaboration was. And it's the music tells you who those characters are, and the lyrics fit that music exactly.
Yeah. Jason, we're wrapping up. You're about to be on the road, right?
I think I'm always on the road.
You're always on the road.
We got a lot of concerts coming up. And, you know, we've got, I'm writing a show called Less, which hopefully will be able to announce soon, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. You know, we did in Chicago, and we're hoping to get that on Broadway soon. I'm writing a lot of new shows. Hopefully I have a new album coming out. We have the Last 5 Years album with Ben Platt and Rachel Zegler that's coming out on vinyl very soon. You know, there's a lot going on here in JRB world, but you know, we're just trying to make more music.
That looked like an amazing performance of the Last 5 Years. That you guys did live. It looked incredible.
It was excellent.
Is there anything we didn't discuss that we should have, or that you want to?
I feel you wrapping up, but I
think... No, I've got a time. If there's...
No, the only...
What's on your mind?
It's... I think the weird thing that I'm dealing with now is, and your questions sort of support this, that... What you do when you are a younger artist is the stuff that will always resonate the most. And so that I deal with the fact that Songs for a New World and Parade and the Last 5 Years are always sort of where the conversation is centered. And I love those shows. But I'm no longer that writer. And I'm very eager to always be centering the conversation on the stuff that I'm doing now. Like, I want to be talking about The Connector, because The Connector, to me, is like a real culmination of the work that I'm doing. But I also know that it's not going to resonate with younger people the way that my younger person's stuff does. And I think I'm just kind of like, as I'm building the arc of a career, that's an interesting place to be. Is like, I have no problems with Songs from the World of the Last 5 Years or Parade, and I will talk about them all day long because they make me so happy and I'm so proud of them. And I just want to make sure that the work that I'm doing now doesn't feel like sort of some asterisk on that part of my career. And I think, again, I think it inevitably does for a lot of artists. I mean, I think when you talk about Alan Menken, you know, we're not talking about Sister Act. We're talking about Little Shop and the Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. And that stuff he wrote 30, 40 years ago. But he's still writing, he's still creating, and he's still very proud of the stuff that he's doing. And I think I have in my head, like, how do I keep the work that I'm doing now at the front of the conversation? That's just that, and that isn't for you to solve. That's just for me to solve.
For The Connector, though, because the cast album's out, and I've listened to the cast album, and it's a really, really great piece. And then if someone wants to go see the show, they have to find a production of it.
Right, which was the same as The Last 5 Years and Songs for a New World, you know, and Parade for a long time.
Is the best entry point for The Connector? It's the cast album, right?
It's a great album. Yeah. But yeah, I think, yes. And hopefully we have a filmed version of that's coming out. So hopefully people will be able to see it that way too. But I think I'm looking forward to there being, we finally got the licensing set for The Connector through MTI. And there's going to be probably 20 productions in the next year. And if it plays out the way that some of my earlier work does, that just sort of like exponentially builds on itself over time. So eventually, you know, in 10 years, I'll be like, everybody always asks me about The Connector, but nobody talks about the work I'm doing now. But
And the show, the other show that you're working on, Less, is that
Less, yeah. There's nothing I can...
we can't talk about it.
I mean, we can talk about it. It's based on a wonderful novel by Andrew Sean Greer that won the Pulitzer a couple of years ago. And it's a beautiful, charming comic piece. And it's, of all the things I'm working on, it's the one that I'm closest to. I'm very proud of it and I'm very moved by it. We were writing it for Gavin Creel. And so when Gavin died, it just sort of stopped us in our tracks for like 2 years. But I think we're sort of... getting back on the bicycle now. And so I there's a workshop coming up and then hopefully a production after that.
And this is where you're writing everything in this room. Is that fair to say or no?
I don't write anything in this room. I finish things in this room.
Everything gets finished in this room.
Everything I write is while I'm walking the dog. I can no longer sit at the piano and write. All I can do is I write while I'm walking, I write in my car, I write while I'm on an airplane, I like write any place other than the piano, and then I'm like, oh, let me get to the piano and finish it. So this is where everything gets finished, but all the writing actually doesn't happen here.
The finishing happens here.
Yeah, the finishing happens.
The writing happens around the block.
Yeah.
Here in the suburbs of New York.
Exactly, yeah. In Nyack, between my house and the beach, that is where all of the writing actually happens, with the dog tagging along next to me.
They got to put a plaque there or something.
Yeah, sure.
Coming soon. Jason, thank you so much for having us in your home.
Absolutely.
Incredible. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you next time. Jason Robert Brown.